Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and get started. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I, Colorado Revised Statutes. The time is 2:02 p.m. The date is June 20th, 2007. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Suite 270, Denver, Colorado. The title setting board today consists of the following. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm here on behalf of Secretary of State Mike Kaufman. To my left is Dan Carton, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, Charlie Pike. We do not have a representative from the Attorney General's office here today. To my far left, though, we do have the board's attorney, Maury Kneiser, Deputy Attorney General, who represents the title board. And to my far right, Ceci Gomez from the Secretary of State's office. For anybody who wishes to testify, there are sign-up sheets on the table by the back door, so please do sign up if you would like to testify. With that, let me turn to today's agenda. We have two motions for rehearing on two proposed initiatives for which the title setting board set titles at its last meeting on June 6th. Let me turn to the first agenda item, 2007-2008, number 17, new State Department and Elected Board for Public Resource Conservation. This is here on motion for rehearing on behalf of petitioners Douglas Kemper and Stuart A. Sanderson. And let's see, who do I have on behalf of the motion for rehearing? If you'll, if you'll come forward, identify yourself and who you represent, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alex Joseph. I'm the attorney for Mr. Kemper and Mr. Sanderson with the law firm of Burns, Figa, and Will. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to address this board today regarding Initiative 17. It is our belief that this initiative violates the single subject requirements of Article 5, Section 1 of the Colorado Constitution. What I'd like to do, if it's all right with the board, is begin with a single subject argument, allow the board to address that. We, as stated in our motion for rehearing, if the board does determine that this constitutes a single subject, we have some thoughts on the title as well, but I would like to save those for later if that's acceptable to the board. Thank you. As you know, this initiative consolidates several state entities into a new Department of Environmental Conservation, and for convenience sake, I will refer to this simply as the department. This initiative establishes the governing principles of the new department and addresses three additional distinct purposes which we believe constitute separate subjects. First, it exempts the department from the requirements of TABOR. Second, it creates trust responsibilities that have to this time been foreign to Colorado law. And third, it alters the methods of appointing executive officers. I know this board is intimately familiar with the requirements of a single subject, and we have stated many of those legal authorities in our brief and the motion for rehearing, so I will refrain from a general overview of the single subject requirement at this time. One of the things that the initiative does is it exempts all funds that are either allocated to or generated by the department from TABOR restrictions. This is made clear in Section 8, subparagraphs 1 and 3 of the initiative. Among the requirements of TABOR are to place restrictions on revenue collection of the state government, to place restrictions on the state's total spending, and to require voter approval on new or increased taxes or the creation of any multiple fiscal year debt or financial obligation. TABOR also includes as part of its provisions that where there's a question of interpretation, the court interpreting any new amendment will choose that which creates the greatest restraint on the growth of government. Here, by stating that TABOR does not apply The initiative not only allows the department to sidestep spending limitations on fees collected by the department, which from last week's title board hearing, I believe, was the stated intent, but it also extends this exception to the appropriations from the general fund to the department, such that any appropriations could avoid any revenue collection limits. This will substantively change the way the general fund is operated to the extent that such funds allocated to the department are exempted from a total state spending cap. While this may be an unintended consequence of the initiative, it is exactly the type of hidden provision that the single subject test is designed to avoid, so that all voters are clear on exactly what the initiative will produce. The second separate subject that I believe this initiative encompasses is it creates trust responsibilities. When these trust responsibilities that are given to the department are combined with the explicit preemption of all other constitutional provisions that may conflict with this new constitutional provision, creates a substantive change to this law. And I would like to acknowledge here that it's true that this board cannot address the merits of a proposed initiative, but it is necessary for this board to look at the substantive effects of a initiative to the extent necessary to determine whether that constitutes a separate subject. To really understand this argument, you need to understand the public trust doctrine. And since the public trust doctrine is something that is a creation of water law, which I know is its own sort of subset and very specialized area of Colorado law, I'd like to step back a little and talk about how the public trust doctrine was created, both in the United States Supreme Court and how the Colorado Supreme Court has determined that it does not apply in Colorado. The United States Supreme Court basically said that the navigable waters of a state and the lands underneath those are held in trust by the people, or by the state for the people. And that is true unless the state says otherwise. Colorado has never held that the public trust doctrine applies to water rights. And this is because of the express protection of property rights that are contained in Article 16 of the Colorado Constitution. The problem here is that this initiative requires the department to prioritize its responsibility and to protect the public ownership and public conservation values in land, water, public resources, and wildlife over economic interests. Furthermore, Section 2 states that all provisions, including these new trust obligations of this new Article 30, will prevail over any previously enacted constitutional provisions. So while it may not be the intent of the proponents, what they have done here is said this department has these trust provisions, and these trust provisions prevail over any previously enacted constitutional amendment, including those that protect private property rights. Basically, this transfers privately owned property into the trust protection of the new department. This creation of a public trust is not necessarily connected to the creation of the department, and therefore it constitutes a separate subject. This type of change is exactly the type of change that was addressed in a 2003 case where the Colorado Constitution, or excuse me, the Colorado Supreme Court, in a petition in evaluating initiatives 32 and 33 for 2003-2004 related to petition procedures, the Supreme Court found they violated the single subject requirement because it affected substantive rights in addition to the primary subject matter, which concerned the procedural mechanisms of the initiative and referendum process. Similarly here, these types of changes to the substantive law by creating the public trust doctrine, which alters current Colorado law, is a separate subject from the fundamental purpose of this initiative, which is to create a new Department of Environmental Conservation. The third subject contained in this initiative is to modify the method of appointing certain governmental officers. The initiative states that officers and board members would be transferred to the department. Several of these various public officials have previously or are currently appointed by the government, or excuse me, by the governor, and then confirmed by the legislature. This initiative would change that process and provide for the department to unilaterally appoint such officials, thereby removing the roles of the governor and the legislature. This is similar to what Justice Martinez addressed in his concurring opinion in Garcia v. Chavez, which was a 1999-2000 initiative 258A. When he thought that altering the constitutional authority of school districts to determine to create a bilingual program constituted a separate subject because it was not an implementing device. Similarly, changing the constitutional authority of the governor to appoint subject to the legislative consent, which is contained in Article 4, Section 6 of the Constitution, by changing this appointment mechanism, it is not an implementing mechanism of creating this department and constitutes a separate subject. Thus, there are at least three subjects here that are in addition to the stated purpose of creating the Department of Environmental Conservation. These would affect various portions of the Colorado Constitution. In large part, this is due to the provision that states that the new Article 30 will override all previously enacted portions of the Constitution. Some of the effects are that it would amend the article relating to GOCO by bringing the new entity under the authority of this newly created department, would significantly amend TABOR by excluding numerous entities that are not an enterprise. It would amend current public trust provisions, would amend the governor's appointment authority, and it would create numerous other constitutional changes that have nothing to do with the creation of the department. Thank you for the board's consideration. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Joseph. Questions for Ms. Joseph? I guess maybe I'll start. And actually, I'm sort of going to start by sort of explaining the way I'm looking at the measure and why I think at this point that it does comprise a single subject. And it's the analytical framework that I'm working from, I kind of want to explain, and I don't think it's inconsistent with anything that you said.
Okay.
But I guess I'd like to kind of go over it and give you a chance to respond specifically to it. I'm going back to a test that the case law has given us from time to time as to whether a measure violates the single subject requirement, and I think it was stated, if not for the first time, but at least it was stated in 95 in the Public Rights and Water 2 case. And basically it's that a measure violates a single subject requirement if it relates to more than one subject, which by itself doesn't seem to add much to the analysis, but that's the first part of the test. Second, if it has at least two distinct and separate purposes which are not dependent upon or connected with each other. And so one of the ways that I'm looking at this measure, like a number of them, is that test sort of talks about multiple subjects versus and multiple purposes, which the idea of subjects and purposes, those are two, I think, interrelated terms, but they're different. And with respect to this measure, it seems to me we could say that the single subject, which we're required to state in the title, and which we stated in the title, is the creation of a new Department of Environmental Conservation. That could be a single subject, but a measure could have one or more purposes behind that subject. And I say one or more purposes because the test in the public rights and water case says it's a violation if you have two distinct and separate subjects which are not dependent upon or connected with each other. So it's not just multiple purposes, it's unrelated purposes. And so I'm not quite sure what to state as the purpose or purposes of the measure, but from my own working thoughts about it, it could be, you know, again, the subject may be the creation of the new department, but the purpose might be environmental conservation, say, or something along those lines. And there may be other statements of other purposes, but even, like I say, even if there are, the question would be if the various purposes, the question would be whether the various purposes are dependent upon or connected with each other. So kind of to go back to me trying to apply that framework to this and relate it to the arguments that you've made, it's with respect to the separate subjects that you've identified.
The first one,
you know, has to do with the Tabor impact, and it seems to me that effect or provision of the measure that exempts not just the revenues but all of the funding exempts it from Tabor, that furthers the purposes of the measure. It makes the new department more independent of or more free of fiscal limitations that might otherwise apply. So it's hard for me to see that as being a separate purpose not dependent or connected with the major purpose of the measure. It seems to further that. I don't know if you want to go ahead and respond to that one.
Part of that depends on how broad you allow that purpose to be. I was looking for it, and certainly not putting my fingers on appropriately, but I think there's a case that's more recent than the Public Water 2 that says it's necessarily connected. And to be able to form this department, you certainly need to create duties and powers, but exempting it from the provisions of Tabor is not necessarily connected. That's one point. The second point that the Supreme Court has made several times is that while your single subject is correct, at the same time, a measure is not allowed to, and I'm reading here from, let's see, 2003 case on initiatives, 2003, 432, 33, what's the subject of these? But basically they're saying the site here is 76 P3rd 460 at page 463. Because these proposed measures would affect existing substantive rights in addition to the primary subject concerning the procedural mechanisms of the initiative in the referendum process, they do not comply with the single subject requirement. And I think that's where the Tabor and the initiative, or in the appointment of government officials and change of the public trust doctrine come into play, because they affect existing substantive rights that are in addition to its stated purpose.
Its stated purpose.
The initiative stated purpose, my understanding, is to create this department.
And I guess I'm sort of challenging that in the sense that it seems to me that there's not much of a purpose behind simply creating a department. Normally you wouldn't do that unless you had some underlying purpose or some purpose behind that. And I'm reading the measure as the purpose having something to do with, my working definition is environmental conservation, which I think would be consistent with consolidating environmental programs in one department, focusing powers and duties in one department, which relates to the issue about whether or not the transferring appointment powers and so forth is a separate subject. But it seems to me that would be that feature of the measure furthers the purpose of environmental conservation to the extent that it, again, is consolidating and focusing governmental authority behind a purpose of, let's say for now, environmental conservation. So in any event, those things all seem to be consistent with a purpose, not of just simply creating a department for the sake of creating a department, but for the sake of achieving a purpose, an underlying purpose.
If your underlying purpose of environmental conservation, that's a very broad topic, and that's even broader than public waters, because not only are we talking about water, we're talking about land, we're talking about mining, we're talking about forests. It is an incredibly broad topic. So I would say if your topic is as broad as environmental conservation, and that all of these, while yes, all of these things do fit under such a broad topic of environmental conservation, that is so far so broad as to not be a single subject in and of itself.
Well,
that would be my response.
Okay, well, that's a good response. And again, I think that, you know, just to mention one other one, that the change in the trust responsibilities, that's pretty significant, and I think I appreciate the argument there, although again I guess I'm still saying that seems to further what I'm viewing roughly the purpose of the measure being, is whether it's stated as environmental conservation or whatever, it seems to further the purpose as opposed to being a separate and distinct purpose. But I don't know, maybe you've already addressed that.
Well, arguably, I mean, depending on how you define environmental, and to a certain extent I realize I'm about to make an argument that sounds an awful like it depends on how you define what is. But water quality and water rights are two very different things. Water quality is absolutely part of the environmental conservation movement. I think that very few people will challenge that. Water rights, water in Colorado is a usufructory property right, where the state owns all of the water and allows private citizens to appropriate the use of that water so long as such appropriators follow a constitutional provision providing for that and statutory provisions that create the precise mechanism of going through the decree process and the water court process and how exactly that process works. But altering those private property rights is arguably different than environmental conservation because it has nothing to do with conserving the environment. It has to do with how this public or how this resource, water, which all of our cities, all of our farmers, various different industries, the entire state is dependent upon the use of water. And by changing the fundamental structure by which this water is put to use in Colorado is not really part of environmental conservation. It is a private property right that is saying, well, while this may have been a private property right, we are now putting this into the trust responsibilities for the government.
Mr. Carton?
Ms. Joseph, you cite the public rights. Well, first of all, I'll say that I concur with Mr. Hobbs's kind of framework for analysis here, and the and citing to public rights and water too, and the standard kind of the two-prong test in that case, as well as our directives from the statute 140.106.5, which provides that the single subject rule is in place to forbid the treatment of incongruous subjects in the same measure, especially the practice of putting together in one measure subjects having no necessary or proper connection. And I agree with his discussion of kind of the distinction between subject and purposes. But overall, I'm kind of in the same place I was a couple of weeks ago as far as seeing a relationship between the purposes in this measure. You do cite the public rights and water 2 case. In that case, the court concluded, to jump to the end, the court said the initiative, if enacted, would establish election and boundary rules for water conservancy and conservation districts, while also requiring effective enforcement and development of a strong public trust doctrine. These two objectives are separate and discrete, and thus must be accomplished through separate initiatives. In your argument about the trust responsibilities, Part B of your submittal, is it accurate to characterize your argument as you have a substantive policy directive in Section 7 that amounts to an establishment of a public trust doctrine, and you also have the creation of a new department, and that those under Public Rights and Water 2 in that analysis are two separate purposes, two objectives separate and discrete? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but does the public Rights and Water 2 case have any have some relevance to your argument, either in that context or in some other framework?
I think it does. I mean, and that's exactly the point, is that certainly it is acceptable, and I will not argue to the contrary, to create a public trust doctrine. And it was tried in the case that was examined in Public Rights and Water 2, has been tried several times before, I believe, by one of the proponents of this current measure. However, it is a separate subject from creating this department from environmental conservation, and that while those two things can be accomplished in two separate provisions in two separate initiated measures, by combining them into one, you promote public confusion. You might put somebody into a position where they are in support of this new department that supervises all environmental functions, but maybe they're not in support of a public trust doctrine. And creating this type of public trust responsibility that has not been known thus far in Colorado law. And the idea of the single subject requirement is to prevent a voter from having to choose in that way, so that the portions of the initiative are connected sufficiently such that the voter has one choice to make. I support whatever the single subject is.
Just one other question then, but again, coming back to the test from Public Rights and Water 2 that Mr. Hobbs specified, two distinct and separate purposes that are not dependent upon or connected with each other. Is it your position that, you know, aside from the argument of whether the measure does or doesn't create a public trust doctrine, that these provisions are completely independent and have no connection to one another?
I would say the connection is so far attenuated, and they're so distinct. I'm not sure I would say no connection. It's a question of degree, and are they connected enough to constitute a single subject under that public trust doctrine? And I would say no.
Thank you.
Maybe since we're focusing right now just on the single subject argument, this would be a good time to hear from Mr. Hamilton on the same issue, and we'll see about moving on to the
that would be fine.
Files, so.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamilton, if you'd come forward, we did get something in writing from you just a little while ago. Did you provide a copy to Ms. Joseph as well?
There is a copy for Ms. Joseph available, and I shall get to her right now.
Okay.
My name is Richard Hamilton. I'm from Fairplay, Colorado. I'm one of the sponsors of the initiative to add Article 30 to the Colorado Constitution, creating a Department of Environmental Conservation. I have made a written response to the assertions and allegations by counsel, copies of which are available to the public, should they so wish. I was going to just sort of go through this But I believe the I would first wish to address what appears to be at the time being sort of a very ingenious bait and switch kind of process being enunciated by the proponents to for this rehearing. At the 140 hearing, the advice and comment hearing and legislative council, legislative legal services, it was enunciated very, very clearly that there is no intent whatsoever to have this document become a vehicle for the installation of a public trust doctrine in Colorado. That also was enunciated here at the June 6th meeting that there is, I have filed three proposals for the initiative for the public trust doctrine. And by the way, each one is titled initiative for the proposal for a public trust doctrine. We do not need to do that surreptitiously. We can do that sort of overtly. Would that be the case? The issue in this case is, in fact, we wish to create a Department of Environmental Conservation. And instead of having a hollow shell, merely like a parking garage without any walls or any kinds of vehicles or anything in it, we would like to go ahead and infuse it with the certain kinds of authorities and powers and responsibilities. And therefore, I will read part of this. The measure does not change Tabor. The measure does propose that no matter of fiscal management contained within Tabor shall constrain the department in funding or operation. The reason for Tabor in this initiative, and I know that you're not here to deal with the merits, as was also stated at the 6th of June hearing, is that the proposed department is an agency where departmental funding is more on a cash basis, discretionary basis, rather than from general ad valorem taxes. There's no real steady state of monies going into a Department of Environmental Conservation. It does not have, quote unquote, a client, much like a school district or a general government. So what happens is there may well come years where there may not be large amounts of revenues from fishing licenses or ATVs or hunting licenses, and if Tabor were allowed to act, it would essentially ratchet down the ability of the department to operate, because as you know, Tabor has had not only its consequence of providing for public votes on increases in funding, which had a very, very drastic unintended consequence that if in fact the revenues of a department or the revenues of an agency or an entity had gone down, it resets the zero point. And this new Department of Environmental Conservation could have lots and lots of vacillation in revenues, et cetera, from various different sources. So having it subject to certain kinds of expenditure requirements within Tabor could do extraordinary harm to its operation. So maybe that can explain one of the reasons Tabor was in fact put in there. It's not put in there in some deceptive, devious manner. The initiatives, Section 7, the stewardship, and the Section 2 provisions, those provisions have to dealing with prior constitutional provisions if conflicts shall arise, were included in an attempt to have the new department be given the ratification by the public. The contention by the petitioners to rehear that the measure is an attempt to install the public trust doctrine has been discussed heretofore. That's essentially a very specious contention that we would do something underhandedly to go ahead and see if we could do something that would be essentially hidden from the public in its effect, but would be what this thing was put in, why Section 7 was put in there, it can be sort of dealt with in the recent Court of Appeals case of Board of County Commissioners, Gunnison County versus BDS and the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. What happened in Gunnison County versus BDS was one of the state agencies sued Gunnison County, as well as one as did a corporate officer, corporate entity in Gunnison County, and saying, listen, there couldn't, the counties could not possibly have the rights of matters of state interest, activities of state concern under the Land Use Act to affect and manage activities on federally managed lands. Well, the Colorado Supreme Court here on the 10th of June denied cert on that and found that, in fact, counties could, through their 1041 proceedings and 1037 Local Government Land Use Enabling Act kinds of processes and provisions, review and issue permits on for mineral resource development on federally managed lands. Whereupon Steve Aquafesca, who was at one time a member of the legislature and now a county commissioner in Mesa County, said, well, we'll just have to have the courts determine what the implications of all of this are. The precise reason that Section 7 was placed into the measure, and I know that you're not dealing on the merits of this issue, was that we were trying to give the public a clear, enunciated, well-documented, fairly exhaustive list of environmental conservation protections of their public ownerships and public values. I noticed that our esteemed attorney here said that the state of Colorado owned the water. I would differ under 16.5. The Constitution does not say that the state of Colorado owns the water. 16.6 does provide the ability of rights, but under 16.5, the water belongs to the public. And the public of the state of Colorado and the state of Colorado as an entity are not exactly the same. And that's been held over and over and over again. We're going to have to go through numerous court contentions to see whether these managed lands. No. Let's have the public vote, having a full definitive list of stewardship responsibilities enunciated so that they can say, these are the ways that this department will be implemented. And the section that says it modifies the appointing of certain kinds of officers, well, I assume that you wouldn't have a constitutional initiative if you didn't sort of change some of the arrangements. The arrangements in this initiative, which if passed, will be passed by the public in a vote under Article 5, Section 1, giving the first right of the public retains is the right to legislate. And it should be noted that the measure has not been introduced to destroy or impede the authority of the governor or constrain the legislature from an ability to act in a specific manner. These are ways that this newly created concept state department will have a collection of authorities and powers to go ahead and promote its responsibilities. And I fully think that these things have, the public has a right to vote on these. And I did quote Legislative Research Memorandum Number 2, bills to contain single subject, and also I quoted Catron versus County Commissioners, 1893. Catron, generality of a title is oftener to be commended than criticized. The Constitution being sufficiently complied with so long as the matters contained within the bill are directly germane to the subject expressed in the title. And I think that the title I set with the last time was clear and fair and did contain not every explicit element that would implement the measure of creating the Department of Environmental Conservation, but certainly would give anybody from off the street a picture of what the intent was. Thank you for your time.
Questions for Mr. Hamilton? Thank you.
If I may, I've got to be adjourned. Someplace to go to work. Thank you.
Ms. Joseph, anything that you wanted to add in response to that? If you'd like to come back to the podium then.
I'd just like to state a couple of points. First of all, to the extent that I insinuated that there was some, that the proponents were trying to sneak something in on the public trust, I really did not mean to say that. It is more that this body's obligation is to look at the plain language of the initiative as it is written. And while it may or may not have been the proponent's intent to create a public trust doctrine, the reality is that you have to go by what the language of the initiative states. and the language that is included here by creating the trust, by referring to public ownerships as frequently and in the manner that it does, it arguably creates that public trust doctrine, whether or not that was the intent of the proponents. Mr. Hobbs, in response to your earlier suggestion of the broad subject, one of the more recent guidances that the Supreme Court gave to this board came in Gonzalez Este versus Lamb, which is a 2006 case, 138 P. 3rd 273, where it stated that the title board must examine an initiative's central theme to determine whether it contains hidden purposes or incongruous measures under a broad theme. And the question here is, how broad is a theme of environmental conservation? Is it too broad to constitute a single subject? And are all of these other purposes that we've talked about today, are they sufficiently incongruous to violate the single subject test?
Thank you. Let's, rather than take a separate vote on the single subject issue, let's move on to the titles as well. And Ms. Joseph, do you want to go ahead and address that part of your motion, or do you have anything more that you want to add?
I do.
And while you're doing that, I don't have anybody else signed up to testify on this particular item. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the motion for rehearing? Have you signed up, sir?
I did, but
okay. All right. You're Mr. Doe?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Ms. Joseph, if you did you want to talk on the single subject issue?
I can.
Well, why don't you come forward and let's hear what you have to say then. You'll identify yourself for the record and who you represent, if anyone.
My name is Philip Doe. I chair an organization called the Citizens Progressive Alliance, and we're co-sponsors of this initiative. I would just like to recall to your memory, as I'm sure you remember, a couple of weeks ago when we were here, we said that, you know, this has one single purpose, and that is to establish a Department of Environmental Conservation, and that it was going, in order to make that department efficient, even workable, it was going to require a lot of housekeeping, significant changes to be made in the way the business of government is conducted, if that department is to be efficient and serve the public purpose. It seems to me that what is being said here is kind of an oblique attack on the idea of a Department of Environmental Conservation. And rather than attacking the thing itself, it would attack the machinery, saying, again obliquely, that machinery isn't necessary. And the machinery that we've decided that is necessary is not necessary because they say so. I think, in our opinion, we've been very forthright about the machinery we think is necessary to make this workable and in the public interest, and we stand by that. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Doe? Okay, thank you. Ms. Joseph, if you'd like to address the sufficiency of the titles, then please.
The purpose of setting a title is to fully express the initiative's intent purposes. I believe this has several, this title, even if the board determines that it has a single subject, has several flaws in that it does not fully express the initiative's intent regarding, or purpose, regarding the appointment of officers and regarding the fact that constitutional provisions will control over any conflicting previously enacted constitutional provisions. In addition, we believe that the statement conflicts between economic interests and conservation stewardship will be resolved in favor of public ownership and public values is a catchphrase, as was determined recently in Garcia v. Chavez, which is the 1999-2000 number 258A. Because it sets forth, it's such a broad, it emits this emotion that people will respond to, but doesn't fully reflect what in fact happens. We have created, for the board's convenience, a red line of the current title of some suggestions which we thought might be able to help these suggestions? Is it easier for me to hand that out or to
if you have copies,
read it? I have a few copies here.
And maybe just describe them for the benefit of.
Let's do that since I don't have enough copies for the public or for the proponents, unfortunately. The first change comes in after specifying the departments and duties would be to say, put a semicolon there, and directing the department to steward public resources and to resolve any conflict between economic interests and conservation stewardship, which sort of plays with that phraseology that we believe is a catchphrase. Also specifying later down after transferring the Board of Commissioners or to the Board of Commissioners the authority to appoint members of certain boards and commissions relating to those programs and entities, comma, replacing appointment by the governor with the consent of the Senate. I believe this makes it clear to the public as to exactly how this is being changed, what authorities are being changed here, and also at the end of the title specifically stating that the provisions contained in this initiative will control over any conflicting previously enacted constitutional provisions, making sure that that point is clearly stated in the title.
Okay, thank you. It is helpful to see. I was going to ask you what your suggestions were, but this is very helpful to have those suggestions in writing. I have some questions about those suggestions, though. I'm not sure. I mean, to the extent that I am mulling over your objection that the titles contain a catchphrase, it looks like you're retaining essentially that language. I mean, instead of saying declaring that the conflict has to be resolved, et cetera, you're saying directing the department to resolve any conflict. But it's basically the language is still there. Maybe I misunderstood your argument.
And the inherent problem is that, not being the proponents, that it's still unclear to me as to exactly what the proponents mean by conflicting or resolving conflicts between economic interests and conservation stewardship in favor of public ownership and conservation values. And I think that's part of it, is I know that the title board took that portion of the title directly out of the initiative, but those terms are not really defined in the initiative. The whole thing certainly sounds good, but in terms of exactly what to mean and how to characterize it in a way that doesn't make it a catchphrase, we struggled with a lot, which sort of brings us back to the fact that maybe setting a title isn't appropriate.
I think the second suggestion, let me just move on to that one, where, I think you're addressing the concern that providing that the commission appoint members to various boards and commissions and so forth is a significant departure from the governor's existing power of appointment. So your suggestion is to work that into the language. I guess I'm reluctant to make that change because it seems to me that, the titles have to be brief, and we don't necessarily want to include everything, certainly every significant feature. And granted that the governor's appointment power, it has a constitutional basis. I'm not saying that's not significant, but it just seems like we've covered that by saying that the power of appointment is transferred to the Board of Commissioners. That's certainly broad enough to embrace the fact that wherever it comes from, whether it comes from the governor or from some other source, it seems to be broad enough to include that. But I'm inferring that you believe that this is just so significant that the voters have to be informed of this in the titles.
I think that's correct. Voters are we all associate, when we elect the governor of the state of Colorado, we assume that by electing that person, he or she will have these powers to appoint certain people, just as our President of the United States has powers to appoint various officers. And I don't know that, even though this does talk about the fact that so this appointment power is coming from somewhere, I think it is so significant that it's coming from the governor. You're actually taking powers away from the governor to this new Board of Commissioners that admittedly is still elected. But I think it's just a clarity type of issue, that it's significant just in how people's framework works to know where this is coming from.
Any other questions, Ms. Joseph?
Okay. Very quickly, just to follow up. As far as the first change goes, specifying or where you say directing the department to steward public resources and to resolve any conflict, I think I agree with Mr. Hobbs said as far as that going to the catchphrase argument, that seems to leave the particular phrase at issue in. And I'd also would think that if we were going to consider that modification, that the policy statement, the policy directive in Section 7 is to both the department and the board, not just the department. As far as the second change goes, I appreciate the argument. I think it's one of the purposes of the measure. I think it's distinct as far as replacing the appointment of many of these agency heads. But I think that the language, and we may be jumping ahead. I think I'm satisfied with the language that is in there, and I think that Mr. Hobbs kind of touched on this. I'm not certain, going back to my initial review of the measure, that all of the department heads, all the agency heads, commission heads, that are impacted by the measure are all appointed by the governor. I'm not sure they are. There may be, in the way this is written, it talks about the governor exclusively. And my last question that I have is, the last change dictating that these provisions will control over any conflicting previously enacted constitutional provision. I know this is going to reveal my lack of attention to the measure, but where in the measure does it say that?
Me to grab my copy of the measure real quickly. Section 2, the last sentence says, should conflict with other Colorado constitutional provisions arise hereafter, provisions within Article 30 shall be held dominant over other previous constitutional provisions.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamilton, I think, is not present. Mr. Doe, did you want to respond at all?
Mr. Doe again. Of course, our preference would be that it was set at the hearing. That would be our preference. I think we went through quite an extensive debate over what would be the best language. It was up on the board, and I see no reason to change it. In fact, I think some of these things are intended to alarm people rather than to edify, and I think that's their only purpose.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the motion for rehearing? If not, I'll turn to board discussion. Any discussion by the board? Pardon.
I'll be brief. On the issue of, on the motion, as far as the issue of the single subject issue, and taking that up first, I'm inclined to deny the motion with respect to the allegation that the initiative and titles don't conform to the single subject requirements. I think that, and I appreciate Ms. Joseph's arguments, they're forceful and they're clear. I said this the last time. I think that there are multiple purposes in the measure. I think that she that the petitioner has specified three of those, the Tabor exemption, the policy directive, and the change in the appointment of the agency heads that will be subsumed on this new department. But I do think that there is a connection. I think that one could reasonably make the argument that they're even necessarily connected. Again, I'd go back to 141.605. Subsection 2 says it is the intent of the General Assembly that Section 1.5.5 of Article 5 and Section 2.3 of Article 19 be liberally construed so as to avert the practices against which they are aimed and at the same time to preserve and protect the right of initiative and referendum. That to me is together with the relevant case law that talks about measures that have two distinct and separate purposes that are not dependent upon or connected with each other, or that are unrelated, or that are incongruous. I think that the purposes in this measure and are dependent. I think there is a single subject, as it's stated in the title, and that is why I would be inclined to deny the motion with respect to not going forward on single subject grounds.
And I agree. And as Mr. Carton alluded to, I think the motion for rehearing is well argued, but I still believe that the measure comprises a single subject, and I also appreciate the arguments about the titles, but I think that I'm not convinced that the titles would be improved by the suggestions made in the motion for rehearing, so I'd be inclined to deny the motion for rehearing. Just go ahead and jump ahead.
Then if
the motion, or if you'd like to move. I'll just go ahead and move then that the motion for rehearing be denied.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded. No other discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. That concludes action on number 17. The time is 2:59 p.m. Thank you. I think we'll keep on going to the next agenda item then. The next agenda item is 2007-2008 number 31, Prohibition on Discrimination and Preferential Treatment by Colorado Governments. This is before the board on a motion for rehearing, and I believe this is submitted on behalf of Polly Baca, Christy Sloss, and Ron Montoya. And Mr. Ramey, I think you're here on behalf of the petitioners. If you'd like to identify yourself and give us your arguments, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Edward Ramey, I'm representing the objectors, whatever we are in this context. And I've taken an oath to be shorter than I was last time. So, a blood promise to the board and to Mr. Westphal. What I'd like to do, similar to what Ms. Joseph did, is go to the single subject issues first and then very, very briefly address the misleading aspects of the title. The single subject issues, and I'm not going to beat to death what we spent about two and three quarters hours on last time, and I've also put in writing. I'm sure the board has had an opportunity to review that, but let me go over a couple of them very briefly again, just maybe primarily for my own mindset, just to make sure that I'm being clear to the board about what our concerns on the single subject issue are. I'm also going to ask the board to help me a little bit in clarifying with the proponents what the basis of some of our concerns are and whether they're real or not. One of the difficulties that we've had is we have not been able to get that clarity, and This is really the moment when I think that clarity has to come forward, absent which it makes the job of this board very, very difficult in terms of setting a title. Let me go, I guess, initially to our first concern with single subject. We probably spent most of the time on this last time, and that is that this measure, in the context of one measure, seeks to prohibit both discrimination and preferential treatment. Last time, this measure came before us with sort of the informal caption attached to it as a measure to prohibit discrimination. This time that's been broadened, I noticed, to prohibit discrimination and preferential treatment. I think in terms of the informal caption, that's correct. These are two different concepts, and whatever preferential treatment means, let me take for the moment, I want to come back to the problem of what those words mean in a moment. Let me take, for the sake of argument, to begin with, the narrowest construct that I can put on those terms, preferential treatment, which would be prohibited by this measure. And by that, I mean something that would have a discriminatory or reverse discriminatory effect. As we'll see in a moment, I'm not sure that's all that this term means. I have no reason to believe it is, but let's assume that that's the case. And I think much of the discussion last time with the board was somewhat based on that presumption, that what we're really talking about here is prohibiting discrimination and a form of preferential treatment that we might put under a moniker of reverse discrimination, something that disadvantages a group, perhaps for a good purpose, but nevertheless disadvantages some other identifiable group. Taking that narrower construct, the principal point that I was inartfully trying to, and at length trying to submit last time, is those are somewhat antithetical and may be incongruous concepts, in that even discriminatory forms of preferential treatment are frequently used as a remedy for discrimination. And it is not uncommon for members of the public, certainly the three people that I represent, myself included, to very likely be in favor of one aspect of this measure, to prohibit discrimination, but not want to prohibit all forms of preferential treatment remedies that are directed and addressed precisely to remedying and curing discrimination. It puts us in a box where to vote on a measure that we favor in one respect, we're being forced to vote simultaneously in favor of something that we would oppose. And that's the log rolling sort of hook issue that we spoke about, you know, at some length last time. And we sort of broke down last time, and the board has done it again today in connection with a measure that we've just heard. You know, what single subject means, and are these really unconnected? Is this all discrimination? Can we refer to this under the general topic of discrimination and eliminate discrimination in all categories, whether remedial or not, whether any some sort of an existing form of discrimination that might already be prohibited by law versus a remedy that a court would put into effect. One aspect, and I'm going to submit to the board, a primary aspect of, I believe, the single subject requirement is to avoid putting the voters in this kind of a conundrum, in this kind of a log-rolling situation where a measure which I presume the proponents suspect, at least, rightly or wrongly, would not be able to pass in this state on its own merits. That is a measure that would prohibit preferential treatment. They are going to attempt to get it passed by hooking it to something that everybody viscerally and otherwise favors. I hope it's almost everybody, and that is prohibition of discrimination. That is one primary purpose of the single subject requirement. So we spent an hour or so last time, I'm not going to continue to beat that to death, but that is a very real concern from our perspective. Now, the problems worsened in this particular case, and here's where I am going to ask the board respectfully to help me with this, is I don't know what preferential treatment, as intended by the proponents of this initiative, really means. I assume it means remedial measures that may have a discriminatory effect to them themselves, but it may also mean something a whole lot broader. And I posed some examples last time, and let me just pose a couple very quickly. is the posting of official notices in a language other than English, namely Spanish. Is that preferential treatment to an ethnic or a racial group? I don't know. It may or may not be. The question, and not with not quite that amount of specificity, but the question has certainly been asked to the proponents at the review and comment hearing with the Office of Legislative Legal Services and Legislative Councils, to would you help us define what you mean by preferential treatment? The response to date has been the term needs no further elaboration. I'm taking the response really from the review and comment hearing. So it may cover something like that. Posting of official notices in another language, it would be a stretch, I would think, to view that as discriminatory, in that I speak English perfectly well. I won't say I speak English perfectly well, but I speak it well enough that I'm not benefited by having a notice also in Spanish, but there is no practical way that I feel disadvantaged because that notice is in Spanish. A couple other examples, a primary one is diversity recruitment programs. If a government office, a state university, decides to go out into a community for the purpose of enhancing diversity on their campus, simply making their programs known within a racially or ethnically or even gender-specific community where otherwise those programs might not be known. Is that preferential treatment or not? There's nothing discriminatory about it. I'm not attaching quotas or seats or points or anything of that nature that might bring in a discriminatory aspect. I don't know. And if preferential treatment is intended to include such things as diversity recruitment programs, that is eliminating that is a different subject. I don't know if antithetical is a word, but it's certainly a different topic from dealing with discrimination one way or another. There are in schools, I am told, programs, for example, that honor the achievements of particular students in ethnic and racial groups based upon their membership in that group, and is simply honoring an achievement that a student group or numbers of students have achieved. Nobody's disadvantaged by that. That's not discriminatory. I don't know if preferential treatment, as defined by these proponents, is intended to cover that. There are programs in schools that work, I understand, that work with teenage mothers. Well, that's about as gender-specific as you can get. Is it discriminatory? I don't think so. I don't think the public would view it that way. Is it preferential treatment? I don't know. So what I would ask the board's assistance with is the proponents need to tell us what they mean, because if they are limiting their definition of the term preferential treatment to something that is indisputably discriminatory, the second point that I'm making goes away in terms of a single subject concern. Now, my first point, that they're still hooking, you know, to somewhat antithetical concepts, doesn't go away. That many people favor prohibiting discrimination but not prohibiting even a discriminatory remedy. That still stands. It doesn't go away. But at least my second point would go away. If they're not willing to say that, however, what that tells me is that, yes, they do intend to cover those sorts of things. Items, programs that are patently non-discriminatory in nature, but could be viewed as preferential treatment of some sort or another, they do intend that to be within the scope of this measure. That is the legislative history they wish to establish, in which case I would respectfully submit to the board there is a huge single subject problem here, to say nothing of the misleading nature of this initiative and what is being attempted to be run by unaware voters. So I'm frankly going to ask the board to ask the proponents what the devil they mean by this term. And if they're not willing to answer it, I would respectfully submit they should not receive a title based upon single subject grounds. A third area, and I'm going to hold to my promise to be short on this, is this issue, and I'm not going to go into the three areas of employment, contracting, and education. I think we laid out in our motion. But the third area is one that went right over my head when I first read the initiative, and that is this exception in Section 3 of the initiative for bona fide qualifications based on sex. When I first read that measure, what it read to me was that existing law concerning bona fide qualifications based on sex and the prison guard situation as recited in the answers or in the response to our motion is a perfect example of this, is what they meant by that. And they were simply trying to create an exception to a prohibition on discrimination. It took a University of Denver law professor, Professor Corrado, who actually is here today to make sure that I continue to understand the concepts, that, you know, they're saying something very different here, and he's absolutely right. What's been recognized under federal law, Title VII law, is a concept called bona fide occupational qualifications based on sex, what they call BFOQ. That type of qualification, which includes the prison guard situation, is addressed in the Johnson Controls case, which we cited in our motion, applies in one area that is covered by this initiative in one area alone, and that is employment, period. That's where it stops. It has never been recognized in any other area, certainly not contracting and certainly not education. There are no existing recognized bona fide qualifications based on sex in the areas of contracting and education. Now, what this measure does is create that. So it legitimizes, it legalizes, in this state it constitutionalizes a brand new form of discrimination and says it is okay to discriminate on the basis of whatever bona fide qualifications based on sex may exist in these other areas such as education. It's okay to do that, of course subject to federal law, but it's okay to do that as a constitutional matter in this state in the context of an initiative that purports, and in fact does by its words, prohibit discrimination. So we've got a measure that within one breath is prohibiting discrimination, and perhaps more, as we discussed a moment ago, across the board. At the same time, it is creating, sanctioning, authorizing, and constitutionalizing a whole new form of activity that is patently discrimination. I mean, that is, I don't know if that was intended by the proponents. I have no idea. Now, if I was going to ask the board to help me and ask them that question too, do they intend to extend this concept into the education and contracting areas? But frankly, whether they intend to or not at this point is almost irrelevant because they've done it in the measure. That's the effect of this measure. If that's not their intent, they ought to go back and start over. Now, there is no reason in the world why these proponents, if they want to oppose preferential treatment, whatever that is, if they want to create and sanction new forms of discrimination, whatever they may be, cannot come before the voters of the state and try to do that. My visceral position on that, I mean, the board can imagine, but they certainly have a right to do that. They certainly have a right to have their measure appropriately titled by this board and sent forward and put on the ballot to do that. But I would submit they don't have a right to connect these disparate concepts, whether they intend to or not. They don't have a right to keep their intentions, their definitional intentions, which are key to whether or not a single subject exists or not, quiet and hidden from this board so that you can't properly do your duties to determine whether or not you have jurisdiction to set a title. So those are basically our concerns on the single subject issues. And I'm going to stop at that point. I do have a few comments I would like to make if the board decides that there is a single subject, despite my quandary as to how you can, but if you so decide, there are a few additional comments that I would want to make on the whether or not this measure is misleading.
Questions for Mr. Ramey? I have one. I mean, you've raised some questions that I expect Mr. Westfall to address about the measure that I would have asked, but I think I'll leave that at least to see what exchange there is when Mr. Westfall presents his arguments. But I guess the main question I'd like to ask about is your argument about log rolling, because it sounds like your understanding about log rolling is different than mine.
That means I lose.
Well, no. you may be right.
Judges worst, have said that to me before, too.
Lose at this level, maybe. It sounded like you're saying basically log rolling is where there's two different things in a measure. One is there to, you know, achieve support where it otherwise could not, you know, in order to get the other one passed, basically. And it seems to me there's more to the definition than that. It's two unrelated things. And I'm really referring to 1-40-106.5, which talks about it and basically tends to, in my mind, define it as being two things that have no necessary or proper connection for the purpose of enlisting support, you know, for one for the other and so forth. And I mean, it seems like it's normal for voters to look at a measure and say, I like this, but I don't like that. But as long as everything in the measure, you know, has a necessary and proper connection, that's not a single subject problem. And it seems to me that apart from whether preferential treatment is, to what extent it may be a different concept than discrimination, it still seems like it has a necessary and proper connection. And so the fact that it may be something different than discrimination by itself doesn't make it log rolling, it seems to me.
Well, let me provide, I guess, a couple answers to that. First off, and most basically, let me go to my second point that I made first and then come in, I guess, to the first one. Not knowing what preferential treatment means, I can't intelligently answer your question. If preferential treatment includes non-discriminatory programs such as the ones that I mentioned, diversity recruitment would be a prime example. I don't think there is any necessary connection, I'll take the word, I don't think there's any connection at all between diversity recruitment programs and prohibiting discrimination. Those are different things. Now, I do take your point, Mr. Chair, that reverse discrimination has a connection to discrimination. So that kind of preferential treatment would fit, I think, well into the proposition that you just posed. But if you move outside of that into broader areas that do not have a discriminatory effect, I don't think there's any connection at all. Telling the University of Colorado that they cannot discriminate and at the same time saying, by the way, if you'd like to increase diversity on your campus simply by making the availability of your programs known in an ethnically specific community, you can't do that. To me, those are two different things. And the proponents have every right to put both of them on the ballot at the same time, but not together, not within one measure. Now, going to where I think you really were getting, if we take the narrower definition of preferential treatment, and I'm pulling definitions out of the air because I don't know what they mean, but if we take the narrower definition that necessarily has a discriminatory component to it, and I define that as some group can perceive themselves as being disadvantaged by the program, then, Mr. Chair, I think your point's well taken, specifically based upon the language of 106.5. I would suggest to the panel, however, that there's a limitation to that. When you have two concepts that, yeah, a voter may favor this one and not like this one, but they'll take the package together. When you have the second component, even in its purely discriminatory context, preferential treatment in its purely discriminatory context, that exists for basically one reason only, and that is to remedy the evil on the other half, which is discrimination. That's why it exists. It isn't some other concept that's just floating around out there. Discriminatory preferential treatment exists to remedy past and existing discrimination. I mean, that becomes antithetical. To force me to vote to prohibit something and prohibit the remedy for it at the same time, or a remedy for it at the same time. Those aren't just, you know, somewhat disjointed items. They are directly opposed. They're putting me in a direct conflict. I'm being asked to vote against the remedy for the very thing I'm being asked to vote to prohibit. And we can, I don't know if I've answered your question well, but I mean, this rises to a level that's different from, I didn't understand a word of the last initiative that was before the board, but there was something about creating a new board to do something, and there may be some aspect of that. I wish you wouldn't give them this power, but I'm okay with you giving them that power. There's nothing really directly opposed to those two concepts. But I may just say, well, I'm going to vote for this anyway, even though I don't like this particular piece of it. This is different.
I'm being asked to vote against the remedy for the very thing I'm being asked to vote to prohibit. So even in its discriminatory fashion, but again, I take the board back, I don't know if it's limited that way. I have every reason to believe the term is not so limited because they won't tell me that it's so limited, and they won't tell this board, and they wouldn't tell legislative counsel in the review and comment hearing. And maybe they'll tell you today if you ask them. I'm hinting.
Okay, good. Thank you. That answers it. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Westfall, would you like to address the question of single subject compliance? And we do have your written response as well. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hobbs. Richard Westfall, law firm of Hale Friesen, appearing here today on behalf of the proponents. I don't really have a lot to add to what we've already filed and what we've in our response to the motion for rehearing, and also to the I think we covered virtually all this ground 2 weeks ago. I don't think it does much to rehash old ground. And I think that for all the reasons that were articulated 2 weeks ago by this board, both by you, Mr. Hobbs, by Mr. Domenico, by Mr. Carton, it clearly satisfies single subject. I don't think it's a close question. The only thing I would like to address is what I think I'm sensing and what I think I'm going to be seeing in the Colorado Supreme Court brief is the idea that somehow or another, because the proponents do not want to get in there and start defining for you all the ways in which we think that, all the situations or all the details as to the applicability or the application or the implementation of the concept of preferential treatment, that by somehow or another, by not doing that, we're engaging in sort of what would be the flip side, where they're going to say, well, now we're being surreptitious, now we're hiding the ball, and that's going to be used as an argument against the proponents. I would like to just sort of lay that on the table. I think that's what's being done here in this situation, and I think we, on behalf of the proponents, we just fundamentally reject that. It's not our task as a proponent of a basic, simple constitutional principle to then engage in all the what-ifs that all the people who may have objections to this constitutional principle may want to gin up as far as, well, if you apply it in this context, it could do this, and then if you apply it in this context, it could do this, and therefore this, and boy, that's all these other potential objects or effects or gee whiz, and let's engage in a debate on that, and that and at any given point along the way in that debate, either one of two things occurs. Either we sort of suggest to something, aha, that's another subject, or we get into something where it's like, that would suggest that maybe you're really intending to do something else, and therefore we trigger the surreptitious aspect, which is one of the two prongs that's set forth in the enabling statute for single subject. And I just want to in our brief comments here, just fundamentally reject that paradigm. It's not our task. We have a very simple measure that has a very simple effect on the Constitution that prescribes very clearly what we're trying to do. It's all very much connected to one another. There's no issue of discongruity, and there's no issue of hiding the ball. The measure is very clear about what we're trying to accomplish in that measure. So it's single subject, and I just would like to leave it at that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Let me ask a couple of questions related to what you just said. I guess I tend to agree that the term preferential treatment is a general term, and that it's really not possible or reasonable to define in every instance exactly what it may mean right now and how it may be applied. And in my mind, it's about as general a term as the term discrimination. And there's probably a lot of case law and even statutory law that tries to define what that is, but that's probably a work in progress even still, I'm assuming. So it doesn't bother me at this point that the term preferential treatment may be general and it may not be perfectly knowable right now. Mm-hmm. That doesn't bother me exactly. But I do think Mr. Ramey raises a good question, and that is, does the term preferential treatment go beyond a form of discrimination? And I think that is something I want to be clear on, because if there's something more, I mean, I've tended to view, as I articulated last time, that preferential treatment is simply a form of discrimination. When one person or group is preferred, then another person or group is disadvantaged. And I think your response includes a statement on page 3, government-sponsored preferential treatment is discrimination. So I think you're confirming my view, but I just want to be clear. Is there something intended by the term preferential treatment that goes beyond discrimination?
No, I think the way we set it out in the brief, and I think the way you're understanding it, is that's where we're coming from. Okay. That's what the intent of the measure is, the way it's been just crafted.
Okay. Pardon?
Thank you. Mr. Westfall, I have a question, and I was going to ask this question before Mr. Ramey made his pitch today. And it goes to something that he brought up, and it kind of arose in my mind in reading his motion and reading your response, and particularly the statement that Mr. Hobbs just referenced on government-sponsored preferential treatment is discrimination. Mr. Ramey says in his motion, there are many forms of preferential treatment that neither confer nor deny privileges, as that term is commonly understood, to any class, e.g. diversity recruitment programs, gender-specific health care programs, provision of official notices in language other than English. Prohibiting preferential treatment of this nature is a distinct and separate subject from prohibiting discrimination. And so I guess I have two-part question. And my first question is, the items that are referenced there, diversity recruitment programs, gender-specific health care programs, provision of official notices in language other than English, would the provisions of the measure prohibit those programs?
I really don't want to get into an interpretation on an application on a program by program basis. All I can respond by saying is the intent of the measure is to just restate what you've looked at in our response in the key language, and that is government-sponsored preferential treatment is discrimination. So to the extent to which you have government-sponsored preferential treatment in the defined areas with a defined, you know, based upon the defined categories, the measure, you know, the measures covers that. You know, as far as, I mean, it's not so simple, because we can go on all day about, well, what aspects of this? You see, it's all fine and good for them to throw out a concept, because they can say, well, these aspects of a program like this are clearly not related to either the three subject, you know, the three areas, or don't relate to the categories, or don't constitute government-sponsored really preferential treatment as the measure is designed to address. And then if I say something, you know, off the top of my head without really looking at it and thinking through all the nuances, then all of a sudden they go back and they look at some case, and it's cited in the Colorado Supreme Court brief, that says, aha, see, there's some purpose. That's the danger about engaging in this level of interpretation of the measure that they're asking this board to do. And I really do think this is the situation that really counsels for getting back to principles 101, as far as your job is to interpret the measure only in so far as necessary to determine what are the central purposes of this measure, what is it trying to accomplish. And as far as all this, these are all levels of implementation and effects and things that all they want to argue about, that they want to try to create a separate subject on, the movements. But at the end of the day, that really does take this board beyond its charge, which is to just simply, you know, drill down enough to take a look at what are we trying to accomplish. And I think you hit the nail on the head 2 weeks ago. I think we're, you know, there's no disagreement about that aspect of it, you know, among the board as I understand it. And I really would like to resist, you know, to getting into the program by program implementation issues, because that really becomes a slippery slope as to, well, somewhere down the road, does that lead us into, aha, there's something that's hidden? Or aha, that's something that now creates a single subject issue. That really is, I think the basic principles of what this board should be doing, I think, would counsel against getting into that kind of level of interpretation of this measure.
And you know that, as always, I greatly appreciate that, and I'm very respectful of your position on that. But I want to assure you that I asked that question because I am trying to do my job here, and I feel that's part of my job. So I'm going to ask you one more question.
Okay.
And I understand where you're coming from, but assuming for the sake of argument for the sake of trying to determine, in my mind, resolve kind of some of the issues that I have with Mr. Ramey's argument. Assuming that one of those three or another of the three programs that are referenced in that program, in that paragraph, or some other type of government-sponsored preferential treatment would be prohibited by the measure. So let's just say, for example, to give some concreteness to this, assuming that diversity recruitment programs would be prohibited by the measure. The next sentence says, prohibiting preferential treatment of this nature is distinct and separate, is a distinct and separate subject from prohibiting discrimination. Prohibiting preferential treatment of this nature is a distinct and separate subject from prohibiting discrimination. What's your response to that statement, to that argument?
I just get back to the basic principles of the measure. I mean, as we cited in our, citing the American Heritage, the definition of preferential means of, relating to, or giving an advantage or preference, preferential treatment. And again, to the extent to which anything is government-sponsored and equates to essentially discrimination by granting preferential treatment, on the plain language of the measure would seem to be implicated. Exactly how that's going to effectuate on a program-by-program basis, I don't think that's where we should be at today in discussing the measure.
Thank you.
Mr. Westphal, I want to bring up a case that, a Florida case that Mr. Kneiser brought to my attention, where the Florida Supreme Court held that a similar measure violated Florida's single subject requirement. And I don't think it's dispositive of the matter before us today, but I want to bring it up. This is advisory opinion to the Attorney General regarding an amendment to bar government from treating people differently based on race in public education. This is a 2000 case, 778 Southern 2nd, 888. And before the Florida Supreme Court was a request from the Attorney General to look at the single subject question with respect to four proposed initiatives that were almost identical and almost identical to the measure before us today, almost word for word. And the Florida Supreme Court held that the measures violated the single subject requirement in Florida. And actually, maybe I should pause there. Are you aware of the case?
I have heard of it. I have not studied it. So
okay.
I don't want to readily concede that. I have not studied the rationale of it or even read the opinion. I'm just aware of it.
And I've only looked at it very superficially. I have not had a chance to look at it really very carefully. It's my understanding, and I'm going to essentially probably make an argument for you here, and also provide Mr. Ramey an opportunity if he wishes to address this as well. It's always been my understanding that Florida has a more restrictive view of single subject than Colorado does. And I think it's reflected in the court's decision here in some of the tests, some of the case law that the Florida Supreme Court applies. Let me see if I can find an example. But the flavor of the court's opinion in the Florida case seems to be that, basically a measure could prohibit disparate treatment generally, but not on the basis of, or not with respect to particular classifications. That once a measure classifies how it applies, what forms of discrimination or preferential treatment it may apply to, and so forth, then those become multiple subjects. And I hope I'm not distorting the court's rationale too much. But maybe to give a clear example where I think the Florida case law is more restrictive, there's discussion in the Florida case that apparently means that in Florida, proponents have to identify every provision in the Constitution that is affected by a proposed amendment to the Constitution. I mean, I just see one of the quotes here. Nevertheless, it is imperative that an initiative identify the provisions in the Constitution substantially affected by the proposed amendment in order for the public to fully comprehend the changes and so forth. And that's viewed as a violation of single subject if that's not done. So, you know, in a quick read of this, it looks like it's a more restrictive interpretation of the single subject requirement. But I am troubled, and that's why I'm bringing it up, that the measure before us today is almost identical to the measure that was before the Florida Supreme Court in 2000. That is perhaps going to be problematic. But it doesn't change my view simply because I do believe the Florida Supreme Court has a more restrictive view of single subject. But
I understand that, what, two other states?
Three
other states have single subject where they've come down at single subject. So I'm going to do a nose count. I'm out ahead. So I do think other states, there are other states you could look to that have found single subject. Number one would be my first response. And second, I would agree with your assessment. It's my understanding, based upon what I read about the Florida Supreme Court opinion, not reading it itself, and that's always dangerous for people who are lawyers. We're supposed to go back and look at the case itself. That, in fact, it was applying a burdensome standard to satisfy single subject that's not close to what we have here in Colorado.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Westfall? Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to? We're on the single subject question right now. I don't think I have anybody else signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to address this? And Mr. Ramey,
do you want me to respond?
Yes, actually, I would like for you to, if you want to. I just wanted to find out if anybody else is here as well. But why don't you come forward, Mr. Ramey?
Anybody else?
I'm going to confine myself to your question. I haven't read that case either, so I have no idea what it says, and I'll be honest about it. And I do want to say, with regard to this initiative has been seen in virtually the same form in other states around the country. And I frankly don't know the extent, if at all, to which it has been challenged on single subject grounds in other states, or even if that issue exists there. So I don't want to make any representations to the board one way or the other about that. From what, Mr. Hobbs, you just read, it sure sounds to me like the Florida requirement is a little stricter and a little different from Colorado's single subject requirement, but it sounds to me, and I'm taking this solely, Mr. Hobson, what I think I just heard you read, because I'm not familiar with this case, it sounds like that's an issue more akin to the old parental rights initiative issue that we had here, and that is, can you take a concept, say, prohibit discrimination, and apply it in multiple areas, or every time you come into a different area, do you have a different subject? If what I think I heard you read out of a Florida opinion were the case in Colorado, I think the most apt objection that we have made would be the fact that it's being applied in the area of contracting, employment, and education. Florida, they would probably fail on single subject grounds, if I'm understanding what you read, for that reason. Given that this is Colorado and we have the parental rights issue, that's a little more subtle of an issue, and we start to get into, well, does this mean different things in those different areas? But so that's about all I can say on that case. My concern is a little different, though, and following up on what Mr. Westfall just said, and I don't mean to put Mr. Westfall on the spot, and I did that, and I apologize to Mr. Westfall for that, and he'll get even with me for it, I'm sure, before the year's out. But the unwillingness, it's not Mr. Westfall's, but the unwillingness and inability to respond as to the scope of that term, preferential treatment, is key. And I think Mr. Carton's question went right to the heart of it. I'm not objecting on the basis of trying to predict all the different ways in which this can be applied. What I'm suggesting to the board is that if preferential treatment can reasonably mean, within the context of this initiative, something wholly different from discrimination, it doesn't belong in an anti-discrimination measure. And I just heard that it well can. Diversity recruitment, which is the question that Mr. Carton asked, is a perfect example. There is no rational way that can be deemed
discrimination. And I've just heard that that kind of program might be within the context of preferential treatment. That gives us two different subjects. They can do that. They can define preferential treatment as broadly as they want within a single measure. But to hook at the discrimination, it has to have some connection, rationally, some congruity with the broadest concept of what discrimination can mean. And that term here, we have just heard, is broader. I think you've got two subjects. And respectfully, I don't think the board can set a title on this initiative as presently posed.
Why? Let me just go to your last point, and at the risk of belaboring this a little bit, I don't understand why diversity recruitment is not discriminatory. It seems like if an institution of higher education is recruiting my group, aggressively recruiting my group to the exclusion of some other group, it seems like that is discrimination against the other group.
Well, if it were excluding another group, I'm going to suggest, Mr. Hobbs, and I think we have the Black's Law Dictionary in our motion for this purpose. Discrimination suggests somebody is being disadvantaged, maybe by intent, maybe by effect, but somebody is being disadvantaged in the sense that they are not receiving a privilege that they would otherwise be entitled to, even if it's just that somebody is putting their thumb on the scale in favor of another group. That disadvantages the group that is not benefited by having the thumb on the scale. These examples that I was suggesting, I would respectfully submit to the board, nobody is being disadvantaged just because the availability of a program is being communicated to what happens to be an ethnically focused group that would not otherwise be aware of that information. Does not disadvantage anybody else who is applying for the program and would otherwise be aware of it. I have no reasonable expectation to keep the pool of applicants down. Now, I may have an expectation not to have the thumb on the scale in some quotas, any form of reverse discrimination, points, anything you might want to say. But simply making the availability of a program known to one group does not disadvantage another group who's already aware of it. Now, the other examples I gave, I think, fit into that sort of concept as well. If there's a program in a school to benefit teenage mothers, and I understand there are such programs, I'm hearing that this measure could prohibit that. How in the world is anybody disadvantaged because anybody who's not a teenage mother, let alone a woman, disadvantaged by the existence of that program? If there is a program in a school to honor black men as they become men, how is anybody disadvantaged by the existence of that program? That is not discriminatory. There is no loss of benefit, privilege, or anything. If there's a Spanish language notice on the voting machine, how is anybody disadvantaged by that? And the question I was trying to get asked is, if you don't mean that, tell us that. And then I understand we've got discriminatory and reverse discriminatory issues here. And Mr. Hobbs, your point has been very clear that it's all discrimination and they should have the ability to address that in one measure. But I'm hearing with trumpets that, well, we really don't want to answer that question. And I don't want to pin this on Mr. Westfalk. I don't think he can answer the question. I don't think he's been given the ability to do that. And I certainly don't want to pull an answer out of him that isn't what the proponents intend. But these kinds of things are different things. They aren't discriminatory, and the public would not view them as involving discriminatory, however broadly you define them. I hope I'm making sense. I hope I'm being at all clear. Perhaps, I mean, the best example would be just a program that does nothing but confer an honor or a recognition or a piece of information on a group that either by intent or just happens to be racially or ethnically or gender or partially specific, with no disadvantage to anybody else, no detriment to anybody else under any conceivable analysis. how you can prohibit that in the same in the context of a measure that prohibits discrimination. I would respect what I suggest. Subjects. They can do it, but not in the same.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else wish to testify on the question of single subject compliance? Yes, sir. If you'll identify yourself for the record, please.
Yeah, my name is Roberto Carrata. I'm a professor of law at the University of Denver College of Law, and I'm here just, I guess, on the side of the objectors. I'm just here to answer your last question, which is what very commonly happens with universities, for example, and I know this at the University of Denver College of Law is true, is we mostly advertise our programs in, you know, the major newspapers, for example. So CU might advertise in the Denver Post, Rocky Mountain News. And in fact, the vast majority of the white community would understand things about CU or DU through those media. But if CU decided that they wanted to increase their recruitment pool among blacks or Latinos by then also placing ads in local black newspapers, black community newspapers, or Spanish language newspapers, that would not disadvantage the white community at all. In fact, probably not that many people from the white community would pay attention to those newspapers, and they're getting plenty of information about these schools in the regular newspapers, Rocky Mountain News and Denver Post. Another example, a lot of the colleges and universities locally recruit from other colleges and universities or high schools in the area, for example. The CU Law School might recruit heavily from CSU, for example. Well, CSU may have a large white population, and so they may get a lot of white applicants as a result of that recruitment. If they wanted to increase the number of people who applied who were from different ethnic communities, they might send somebody to a historically black college and university, for example, to do a recruitment there. That would not, again, disadvantage folks from the white community. And in fact, my guess is CU, I can't speak for CU, but they'd probably recruit outside of the state as well, and probably do that mostly at universities and colleges that are majority white universities and colleges. But if they wanted to add a historically black college or university, or a college and university in a largely Hispanic area, they could do that. That would not be a discrimination or disadvantaging anybody from the white community. So that's a direct response to your question.
I guess I'm still troubled by that because it sounds like what you're describing is recruitment across multiple markets that you, under that description might even be equal recruitment of different groups, minority and majority. But I guess I'm in a more extreme case, I can see that recruitment exclusively of a particular group could be discriminatory. You know, where an educational institution says to a particular group, here are the programs we have for you. Here's how you can apply. Here's how, you know, here's the forms. Here's who you talk to, you know. To the exclusion of another group, it seems like that is discriminatory.
Yeah, I would say that is. But that's not typically what happens.
Right.
You have the same recruitment people. They're saying the same thing. They're just trying to reach out to a group that's not covered in their general recruitment practices. It doesn't disadvantage anybody in any way. It doesn't discriminate against anybody in any way. Certainly, none of that goes to the bottom line of a seat in the class. So it's fairly benign kinds of things. Could somebody put a postage stamp on a letter that they know is going to a black applicant, right? What if a black alum writes a letter to all the black applicants who have applied to CU? Can CU have postage for those folks? That does not discriminate against anybody else. And yet, under undefined preferential treatment term, broad definition of preferential treatment, the proponents don't seek to limit it in any way, those sorts of things can happen. And my guess is the vast majority of the electorate would not think that's what they're voting for.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
I don't know whether there's a motion. I guess, frankly, I'm not convinced that the measure violates a single subject requirement, but I don't know, Mr. Barton, open to discussion. But.
And just very briefly, I'd agree with that. And, you know, I Mr. Ramey's argument is a strong one. I am and well thought out, and I thought a lot about it, and I think it's articulated well in his motion, but it just comes down to the fact that I disagree. And it's going to the statement in the motion where the objector posits that there are many forms of preferential treatment that neither confer nor deny privileges. And it lists some examples of those programs and is followed by the statement prohibiting preferential treatment of this nature is a distinct and separate subject from prohibiting discrimination. And I just respectfully disagree with that. I think that discrimination is the connector. I think that discrimination is what makes gives the measure congruity between the purposes of the measure. I think it has a single subject. Mr. Ramey said preferential treatment exists to remedy past and existing discrimination, and that's antithetical to prohibiting preferential treatment. I hope I'm stating that right. And again, I just, for purposes of this measure and the single subject requirement, and again, without stating at all the relevant provision, the statutory and constitutional provisions and judicial precedent, I'm of the same position as I was 2 weeks ago. And while the arguments are persuasive, I'm not completely persuaded, and I am in the same spot I was as far as being inclined to deny the motion on the single subject grounds. The other thing that I wanted to address very briefly, Mr. Chairman, was is the argument about subsection 3 in the measure. And that this is the provision that Mr. Ramey has argued. It's creating, authorizing, sanctioning, and constitutionalizing this type of discrimination. And again, I strongly disagree that this is kind of the outcome of this particular provision. And whether it's appropriate or not, and it's up to the chair, Mr. Ramey may want to respond to this, but I think that that this particular provision, with the prefatory language, nothing in this section shall be interpreted as prohibiting bona fide qualifications based on sex that are reasonably necessary to the normal operation of public employment, public education, or public contracting. Again, notwithstanding Mr. Ramey's forceful argument here, to me, this particular provision is not necessarily an affirmative directive that creates, authorizes, sanctions, or constitutionalizes the described action here. You know, and I'm not trying to be cute, but it seems to me this is more of a kind of an instruction on construction. It's not the type of affirmative provision that creates a separate subject, creates a separate purpose. I'm not even sure it amounts to an exception necessarily. It gives direction on specifically what the provision is not to be interpreted to do, or as to be interpreted to prohibit. And I think in that regard, it leaves the door open for, or acknowledges that there may be other provisions out there that are relevant to that particular prohibition. And so I did want to respond to that particular point, because I didn't think that, and I think specifically the argument there was that, again, this was another ish, this was another separate subject or a separate purpose that was unrelated to the subject. These are incongruous effects, surreptitious in nature, that will indisputably surprise and mislead the voters. The motion says the initiative contains a provision legalizing a form of discrimination and thereby creating and sanctioning a new form of discrimination within a measure that purports to prohibit discrimination. Again, I know it's not the board's job to go to the merits of the measure or to the kind of construe the measure, but I just, for purposes of the single subject discussion here, I disagree with that particular position.
And I agree, Mr. Carton. I actually appreciate you bringing that up. For the record, we didn't have much we didn't have discussion about subsection 3, and I tend to agree with your interpretation of that. And I don't know that I have anything else to add on the single subject. I do view the measure as prohibiting preferential treatment that is discriminatory in nature, and that's kind of an important to my resolution of the single subject requirement, because it leads to my conclusion why I don't think there's log rolling here, for example, because I think there is a necessary and proper connection between the prohibition on discrimination and the prohibition on preferential treatment. I just don't see two separate subjects having no necessary or proper connection. I don't know. So that's probably more than I need to say. It sounds like there's not a change of heart on the part of the board on the single subject question. So let's move to the adequacy of the titles. And Mr. Ramey, I don't know. Did you want to address that now? You said you would briefly address that if we got to it.
Yeah. I was briefer this time.
That's not saying
much. Thank you, Mr. Westmore. I'm not going to tick through. I think we identified our primary concerns in our written motion for rehearing. I'm not going to just tick through those. There's one additional one I want to raise. I didn't put in there. Since we're still at the rehearing, I think I get to do that with the board's concern, but I want to make sure it's on the record. And then there's one in there that I want to focus on. The additional one is this, and it's an incongruity between paragraphs 4 and paragraph 7 of the initiative, in that what paragraph 4 says is, nothing in this section shall be interpreted as invalidating any court order or consent decree that is in force as of the effective date of this section. Presumably, unless there is a court order or consent decree that's in force as of the effective date of this section, a court order or consent decree in the future would otherwise fall within the prohibitions of this measure. I think that's the natural reading of that paragraph. And yet you go down to paragraph 7, and it says the remedies available for violations of this section shall be the same, regardless of all those things, as are otherwise available for violation of then-existing Colorado anti-discrimination law. Well, that is changing the law, because the remedies, future court orders and consent decrees, will be a difference from what will exist as of, I presume, the effective date of this measure, or the minute before the effective date of this measure under Colorado anti-discrimination law. Now, how the dickens you express that? I think I could come up with a suggestion, but I haven't really thought it through, but I think that needs to be in the title, because this does change the remedies that will be available. Second point is one that we did address in our measure, and that is coming back to this point that Mr. Carton just disagreed with me on, but there's also a disclosure issue. And by the way, Mr. Carton, I do respect your analysis, and I have no response. And I certainly understand it, and it's a difficult question to wrestle with. This bona fide qualifications based on sex. The law is being changed here. The law is being changed remarkably here, in that a form of discrimination, and Mr. Carton, and I understand this, respectfully takes exception with my viewing this as sort of enthroning a new form of discrimination. I think it does that. I think it does it within the context of a measure that purports to prohibit discrimination. But
from a disclosure perspective, putting single subject aside, from a pure disclosure perspective, I think it is very important that the voters of this state realize that while they are, and be informed, that while they are prohibiting discrimination, they are taking out of that prohibition and therefore allowing a form of discrimination which has never been recognized in this state before. Discrimination based on bona fide qualifications based on sex outside of the employment area. That doesn't exist in the state right now. And it will exist, at least with regard to the construct of this constitutional measure, by being excised out of the prohibition on discrimination. And I would respectfully submit surprised of that law. It's like the old, we cited the old parental notification case where they were redefining when life began. Court's appointment, albeit almost 18 years ago now, 17 years ago, was that if the voters are going to make a significant change to the law of the state within the context of a measure the principal focus of which is on a, I wouldn't say a different topic, but a broader, more focused topic, they should be apprised of that change. Clearly in the title. Otherwise, our other points, I think, are fairly well set forth. I think they belong in front of the and in connection with, and not behind it. Very important and very basic. Yes, Mr. Hoffman, I'm trying to escape.
Thank you. I know you're doing your best. There's something you didn't address, but it's in your written motion. I do want to have some discussion about. You point out that the titles say at the beginning that it prohibits the state from discriminating, and then it's much later in the titles that you learn that state means not just state government, but it means a political subdivision or government instrumentality of or within the state. And I am wondering about, I mean, and I can defend that. I mean, I think that's what the measure does. It prohibits, you know, the state from discriminating against or prohibiting or granting preferential treatment. And then it defines state very broadly to be basically, I think, state and local government. And it's all there, but that does bother me a little bit to say prohibiting the state from discriminating, and I just don't. I am, in my own mind, still trying to think that through. Would it be better in your mind to fix that deficiency which you brought up if we said prohibiting state and local governments from discriminating against or granting preferential treatment, and then possibly deleting the clause that defines state? Would that be a better approach? Something like that.
It's, Mr. Hobbs, I think it's moving in the right direction. My concern, I think you got to put it all in there. And I'm not just saying that because I'm trying to gum up the proponent's title, but this prohibits East High School. I don't want to go back into the realm of preferential treatment again, but it's going to prohibit East High School from having a program for pregnant or for teenage mothers. It's going to, as I read this initiative, as part of the Denver public school system. I don't think a voter, when they see state or even state and local government, being fairly apprised of that. I mean, the best I can do, I'd probably go to much greater length than acceptable either to the board or the proponents, but I think at a minimum you got to use the language from their definition. Cover all kinds of stuff, not just states and cities or state and cities and counties, but school districts, the RTD, heaven knows what else, special districts.
Okay.
Universities, et cetera.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Westfall, would you like to respond to the motion for rehearing on the question of the sufficiency of the titles?
I believe the title is clear, Mr. Hobbs and Mr. Carton, and we just urge that the board reaffirm what the title is set 2 weeks ago.
How do you feel about in the second line, instead of saying prohibiting the state from discriminating against or granting preferential treatment, et cetera, saying something like prohibiting state and local governments from discriminating against or granting preferential treatment. Would that be better or worse in your view?
I think in that situation, I almost believe that the cure would be worse than that. I think the language that's in the title itself, making it clear down in the title, it says making defining state to include the state of Colorado, agencies or department of the state, public institutions of higher education, political subdivisions or government instrumentalities. I just think that that's, I think that's accurate. I mean, and that's in the title that's been set. And I think the fact that that's down a few more lines in the title in no way makes this title in any way misleading. And I just think they're looking for an argument to try to say that the title is misleading. I don't think there's anything misleading about it at all. I think anybody, once they take just a few moments and inform the reader, the voter, informs him or herself as to what we're talking about here, a quick perusal will immediately grasp that fact as they look down towards the title. I think the staff did a wonderful job on sort of balancing out, clarity and simplicity, did quite a good job, and I would urge that they just that the title board sustain what it did 2 weeks ago.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Westfall? Thanks. Anybody else wish to testify on the sufficiency of the titles? Hearing none, then I'll turn to board discussion of the titles. Any discussion? I guess I'm not inclined to suggest any amendments to the titles. I am a little concerned about the reference to the state in the second line, but I tend to agree with Mr. Westfall. I think that the titles balance several considerations, and I believe I can understand why the measure is drafted the way it is, as far as prohibiting discrimination or preferential treatment by the state, and meaning that to mean basically the state and its political subdivisions of the state, and instrumentalities of the state, it seems like we've dealt with it well enough with the clause that explains what the state includes. So I don't think I have a desire at this point to make changes to the titles as previously set by the board.
And I concur with that, Mr. Chairman.
A motion. I guess I'll move that the board deny the motion for rehearing.
Second.
No other discussion. All those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. That concludes action on number 31. For the record, the time is 4:09 p.m., and that concludes our agenda for the day. Thank you very much.